Hi, this is Derek from Growth.me. Welcome to the Food of the Gods book summary. This is a book written by Terence McKenna, first published in 1992. Food of the Gods says psilocybin mushrooms were responsible for the unusually fast evolutionary growth of the human brain. Also, it talks about how our relationships to psychoactive plants, including caffeine, sugar, and alcohol, have shaped human cultures. And finally, how we may restore personal, social, and ecological balance in the world. Here's my top quote from this book. Most people are addicted to some substance, and more important, all people are addicted to patterns of behavior. End quote. First, who was Terence McKenna? Well, he captured the attention of the post-1960s counterculture. He was a lecturer, author, and ethnobotanist, which means he studied how specific plants have shaped human cultures. In this book, Food of the Gods, which is also his most popular, he reveals a theory that psychoactive plants may have catalyzed the evolution and the expansion of the human brain over 3 million years. This happened at a speed scientists are still astounded by, and it was this growth in intelligence that allowed us to successfully spread across the planet and now sit at the top of every food chain. However, this success came at a cost to us. With modern cities and technology, people feel more alienated than ever. This is exemplified by the ever-rising rates of mental illness and use of pharmaceutical drugs. There was also a tremendous destruction happening to the oceans, rainforests, and planets. And McKenna says that reawakening our relationship to certain psychoactive plants may help to pull us out of these negative trajectories by allowing us to experience the interconnected relationship between us and nature. Now, here's a quote from Aristotle. He said, "It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it." End quote. So, what does that mean? Well, some parts of McKenna's theory will probably turn out to be incorrect as future scientific and archaeological evidence is uncovered. However, his ideas have stimulated and provoked many people to think in novel and unexpected ways, and they might do the same to you. So, feel free to entertain these thoughts over this book note. So, the first lesson from the book is: human-plant relationships shape culture and have done so for millennia. In Gombe Stream National Park, which is in Tanzania of East Africa, scientists noticed a chimpanzee tribe doing something very weird yet fascinating. And by the way, this is the same place that Jane Goodall became famous for her long-term study of chimps. Anyway, the scientists saw that one type of leaf kept showing up undigested in the chimp poo of the tribe, so they wondered, why would these chimps be eating leaves they couldn't digest? And the story gets stranger. It's because they found that every 10 days, the chimps would wake up, and instead of going to their usual breakfast fruit-eating spot, they walked more than 20 minutes away just to find these undigestible leaves, which the scientists found out were from the Aspelia plant. So the chimps would pick off an Aspelia leaf, roll it around their mouth for a minute, and then swallow it whole. And they repeated this about 30 times, swallowing 30 small leaves, and then left. Very strange. And this behavior was a huge mystery to the researchers until one day they heard about two new discoveries related to this Aspelia plant. First, a biochemist at UC Irvine called Eloy Rodriguez had discovered a chemical in Aspelia leaves called theobromine A. And at the same time, Neil Towers at the University of British Columbia was studying the same oil, but coming from a different plant, and he found that theobromine A acted as a strong antibiotic, killing bacteria and also helping get rid of parasitic worms in the intestinal tract. So now these chimps' strange behavior was starting to make sense. What if they were eating the leaves as a kind of herbal medicine? And the scientists wondered if the native people living nearby the park also knew about these leaves, and it turns out they did. They used the leaves to treat wounds and stomach aches, and what's even more mind-blowing is that the native people only used leaves from three of the four local Aspelia species, and these were the same three species used by the chimps. What does this mean? Well, for many thousands of years, our relationships to plants have shaped human cultures in deep ways. Just like some chimps will walk out of their way to get medicinal leaves, we humans have rearranged vast empires to access certain plants and plant substances. But just like a goldfish can't see the water it's swimming in, these plant relationships are so fundamental to who we are that we're usually not aware of them. Well, first, let's look at sugar as an example. Even until the 1600s, sugar was a rare and luxury commodity in Europe. Except for a few kings and nobles, most people had never eaten sugar. Then, in the 1700s, sugar became cheaper and it became available to the middle class for the first time ever. And as soon as people got a taste of it, the demand surged. According to the BBC, average sugar consumption in Britain rose from 4 pounds per person in 1700 to 18 pounds in 1800, and then to 36 pounds in 1850, a massive increase. Around the same time, tea, coffee, and cocoa also started being imported, and they also became very popular because of their taste, because they're all stimulants, and because they're all boiled drinks, which helped to stop the spread of waterborne diseases, which were a big problem at the time. Another important fact is these substances are bitter, so people drank them with lots of sugar. So the craze for coffee, tea, and cocoa reinforced the craze for sugar, and in just a couple hundred years, these four plant substances, including sugar, went from being almost unknown to being consumed by everyone, most people in Europe. And also importantly, they became the basis for entire trade empires and military fleets. By 1750, sugar made up one-fifth of European imports, even more than grain. To satisfy this huge demand, dozens of plantations were established in the New World, especially the Caribbean. And the first indentured laborers who worked there were white, but those kept getting sick from diseases like malaria and yellow fever. So, needing more workers and ideally ones who wouldn't drop dead of tropical diseases, those plantation owners soon switched to slaves from Africa. And it's estimated that at least 10 million people were brought across the Atlantic. On the ocean voyage alone, between 8 to 18% of them died, and the rest were forced into a degrading life of hard labor, a dark chapter in human history. So despite centuries of Christian moral conditioning, Europeans easily turned a blind eye to the wholesale kidnapping and transplantation of millions of people to satisfy their newfound taste for sweet cakes. And the slave trade continued for over 200 years until slavery was finally abolished in 1807. Yet today, sugar has only become more popular. Average yearly sugar consumption has multiplied to over 160 pounds per year per person, according to the USDA. On average, we now eat over 10% of our calories from added sugar. And let's be clear, sugar is totally unnecessary to the human diet. People survived for hundreds of millions of years without it. It's nothing more than a kick. And let's also notice for a moment that sugar is not a harmless kick at all. It's responsible for tooth decay and obesity, and studies show the countries with the highest sugar consumption also have the highest rates of type 2 diabetes. Yet we still can't resist picking up one more cookie if it's sitting there on the table. Why is that? Well, most of us would say it's because sugar tastes great, and it does. But a deeper explanation comes from scientists who found that daily binging of sugar releases dopamine in our brains the same way addictions to hard drugs are formed. Yet in our culture, we put sugar in the food category and kids happily consume it daily, often showing emotional outbursts or distress if they can't get their fix. Now let's switch gears and talk about coffee, another substance that feels essential to daily life. 64% of Americans drink coffee every day, often more than one cup. And on average, we spend over $1,110 on coffee every year. Now, saying that you're addicted to coffee and need it to function has become a predictable joke. Nonetheless, coffee fits the definition of a drug because it is a stimulant and changes how one feels and behaves. Caffeine suppresses tiredness and makes one better able to focus on repetitive and boring tasks, and that's probably why coffee is one of the few psychoactive substances not only tolerated but encouraged by modern capitalist culture. In 1952, a Pan-American Coffee Bureau ad campaign broadcast the message, "Give yourself a coffee break and get what coffee gives you." And overnight, the term coffee break was born. Soon, industrial unions were negotiating for coffee breaks to be written into every single union, a new union contract. Today, it's almost impossible to imagine what the modern office worker culture would look like without coffee. Yet you may be surprised to learn the earliest evidence for coffee drinking only goes back about 500 years. In the Middle East, coffee was first drunk by Sufi mystics who used it as intoxication and to aid concentration while repeating the name of God. Soon coffee houses were springing up everywhere, including in Mecca, where people, energized by coffee, passionately discussed politics. While coffee was actually banned there in 1511 in Mecca by the more conservative and orthodox imams who worried the drink stimulated radical thinking, although that order was very soon overturned by a higher level of government. Now, banning coffee on fear of revolution sounds a bit crazy, yet their fears may not have been totally unfounded. Terence McKenna observed that coffee may have stimulated French people into revolution only 100 years later. Now, here's a quote from the book. "Coffee was introduced in Paris in 1643, and within 30 years, there were over 250 coffee houses in the city. In the years immediately preceding the French Revolution, there were nearly 2,000 coffee establishments operating. If wild talk is the mother of revolution, then certainly coffee and coffee houses must be its midwife." End quote. So what's the lesson here? Well, coffee, like sugar, looks innocent on the surface. Our double mocha soy macchiato from Starbucks helps us to get through those dreary Monday mornings a little more easily. Yet, when most people collectively start drinking these stimulants, it's no exaggeration to say that coffee reshapes our culture in its own image by enabling and reinforcing certain behaviors. Coffee helps us get focused on boring work a little faster and makes our speech a little more feverish, among other effects. Now, what would the world look like without sugar or caffeine? There'd be no McDonald's, no Starbucks, or pretty much any other fast food restaurants or coffee shops as we know them today. And these are only two plant substances that we've looked at out of thousands that shape our society. Now, here's something else to think about and what we're getting at. What if in the forgotten past we had relationships with other plants that shaped human culture in radically different directions? Okay, a summary of this first lesson. In the same way that chimps in Tanzania changed their behavior to get medicinal aspilia leaves, humans also have radically reshaped our cultures and behaviors to get certain plant substances. Sugar, caffeine, tea, and cocoa went from totally unknown just a few hundred years ago to becoming a European craze that caused the slave trade a couple hundred years later, and today we can't imagine what life would look like without them. And now we're on to lesson two. Pre-humans may have consumed psilocybin mushrooms on the African savanna, accelerating our evolution. We humans have the largest brains in the animal kingdom in proportion to our body size, yet our brains actually used to be a lot smaller, and then in the past 3 million years, human brains actually tripled in size, with the fastest growth happening between 800,000 and 200,000 years ago, and scientists are still unsure of how our brains grew so big so fast. This is a big deal because our large brains allow us to be, well, human. Everything that is uniquely human about us stems from our cognitive abilities, including language, painting, poetry, sports, religion, politics, music, and much more. And to put this in perspective, the brains of our closest animal relatives, the great apes, like chimps, gorillas, and bonobos, their brains barely changed in size in the past 10 million years. So why did our brains grow so much? Well, some scientists believe that cooking is responsible. When humans began cooking, it allowed us to consume more calories with less energy needed for digestion. Our intestines became a lot shorter, and a lot of that new energy was diverted from digestion to our brains. On the other hand, other scientists say that widespread use of fire for cooking only happened after our brains had grown a lot. You know, in other words, cooking was the effect of being smart, not the cause. But nobody is really sure yet. There is another theory that looks very promising, though. Some scientists have noticed that the fastest brain growth in humans happened at the same time the climate was changing most rapidly. So they speculate that the times of climate fluctuation put a large pressure on humans to develop bigger brains that helped us to adapt to rapidly changing environments. In plain English, that means if the forest that you've been living in is suddenly shrinking and you're forced into the grasslands, then you'd better be smart enough to find new ways of putting calories in your mouth or you die. So the smartest and biggest brained and adaptable humans lived and passed on their genes, triggering this brain growth in times of climate fluctuation. Now here's where Terence McKenna steps in with his own guess for what caused the brain growth. And if you've heard of Terence McKenna before, then you might know where this is going. Well, he says that when climate change forced our ancestors from the forest to the grasslands, many thousands and millions of years ago, they were suddenly surrounded by hooved herbivores. And considering how many prehistoric paintings feature bison, these animals were likely an important food source, and we followed them around. And this also means that we came into contact, constant contact, with the manure of these animals. And some hallucinogenic mushrooms, like Psilocybe cubensis, prefer to grow in cow manure. And these Psilocybe cubensis mushrooms, which are a dung-loving species, are often called magic mushrooms. And if there were these psilocybin mushrooms growing in ancient African cow pies, then would humans have tried them? Well, it's very likely. Unlike animals like the panda, who only eat bamboo, humans are an omnivorous animal, and our dietary flexibility is a main reason we're so successful in every environment that we've entered, from jungles to deserts to arctics to tropics. Almost no animal is as adaptable or can eat as many types of foods. And certainly mushrooms would have been noticeable to a hungry wandering ape with their unique shape and inviting smell. Now, Terence McKenna also says that psilocybin mushrooms would have given these pre-humans or proto-humans three key evolutionary advantages. First, because small doses of psilocybin slightly enhance visual abilities. This was shown by a scientific study in the 1960s by Roland Fisher that found people who consumed a low dose of psilocybin could detect more quickly when previously parallel lines became skewed. To hunters and foragers, this slightly enhanced vision would have been very useful, giving them an edge in spotting food and avoiding predators. So that's one advantage. And second, slightly larger doses of psilocybin stimulate restlessness and arousal. As McKenna says wryly, stimulated arousal in apes leads to what a scientist might describe as more instances of successful copulation, another slight evolutionary advantage. Finally, at high doses, psilocybin induces a transcendent state, a state where profound self-reflection occurs. Many people report feeling a sense of unity and interconnectedness, psychological boundaries dissolving. And from the outside, these altered states of consciousness may be labeled as simply drug-induced hallucinations. Yet maybe the experience shouldn't be brushed aside so quickly. Roland Griffiths of Johns Hopkins University began the first modern scientific studies on psilocybin in 1999. Psilocybin, again, being the active ingredient of the so-called magic mushrooms. And these studies that began researching the effects of a psychedelic experience for people who are depressed, addicted to cigarettes, or dying of cancer. And the lead researcher was shocked because in questionnaires collected a month after the studies, more than two-thirds of patients rate their psychedelic journey as one of the most important experiences of their life. In fact, about 50% say it's the single most spiritually significant experience of their life, on par with the birth of a child or a death of a parent. What this means is, a single experience with psilocybin is very powerful and significant. And the same researcher found that psilocybin creates a long-term measurable personality change, something traditionally thought to be fixed after the mid-20s. Psilocybin consistently made people score higher in traits related to openness and creativity. And these are scientifically measured, you know, traits. So, Terence McKenna's theory is not that archaic apes ate mushrooms and their brains spontaneously grew bigger. Rather, he thinks that hallucinogenic experiences opened these apes' minds to novel ways of thinking, new patterns of behaving, and, most importantly, more complex expressions of language and culture. This might include more effective and coordinated hunting strategies. It might include shared religious beliefs leading to more cohesive communities, especially it would include new ways of using language. Here's a quote from the book. Psilocybin specifically activates the areas of the brain concerned with processing signals. A common occurrence with psilocybin intoxication is spontaneous outbursts of poetry and other vocal activities such as speaking in tongues. End quote. So, the increasingly complex nature of social life among those pre-human apes would then have created an evolutionary preference and a selection pressure for humans with ever larger brains and more mental power. And in fact, in 1992, the British scientist Robert Dunbar became famous for showing a connection or a correlation in primates between the size of their social groups and the relative size of their neocortex. And if you don't know, the neocortex is the newest part of the brain used for processing complex information. So what Dunbar discovered was that the neocortex is relatively small in primates that hang out in small tribes, like the Tamarkan monkey, which lives in groups of about five. But as you study primates living in larger and larger groups, you see their neocortex is also becoming relatively larger and larger. And this led Dunbar to what's known as the social brain hypothesis, which says that humans evolved a complex brain to handle social relationships within the tribe, rather than to handle their outer environment as previously thought. So a summary of this lesson: human brains tripled in size in the past 3 million years. This fast growth happened during climate fluctuations, and when our ancestors were being pushed from forests into grasslands, they may have found psilocybin mushrooms. And these could have offered some evolutionary advantages like enhanced visual acuity at low doses, enhanced stimulation at medium doses, and at high doses, the introduction of more complex patterns of language and culture. Studies show that hallucinogenic experiences make people measure higher in personality traits related to openness and creativity. And now we're on lesson three, which is prehistoric artifacts hint at the ritual use of psychoactive plants. On a hard-to-reach plateau in Algeria, North Africa, there's a place called Tassili en Agir, which is home to thousands upon thousands of ancient artworks. This place is now a desert, but 10,000 years ago when these cave paintings and engravings were created, its surroundings were a lush savanna. And many of the paintings portray large animals like antelopes and cattle herds. Other paintings show abstract geometric patterns or humans engaged in hunting and dancing. This place is seen as one of the most important centers of prehistoric art in the world, a UNESCO heritage site. And one of the most striking paintings in Tassili en Agir is of a figure. It's believed to be a shaman wearing a mask striped like a bee, and it looks like he's doing some kind of dance or ritual. But the most interesting part of this painting is that this figure's hands appear to be full of mushrooms, and his body seems to be covered from head to toe in small mushrooms. And that's not all. There's another painting in Tassili en Agir of the so-called mushroom runners, and here's how Terence describes the second painting. Quote, The shamans are dancing with fists full of mushrooms and also have mushrooms sprouting out of their bodies. In one instance, they are shown running joyfully, surrounded by geometric structures of their hallucinations. The pictorial evidence seems incontrovertible. End quote. And if you're listening to this, you'll want to check out the written summary on the Growth.me website, and you can see these paintings for yourself. Well, what could these paintings mean? What are they evidence of? Are they just regular mushrooms drawn for their interesting shapes? Or could they be psychoactive mushrooms that were a part of the rituals of these archaic people? Well, these are not the only prehistoric artworks that raise questions. Take, for example, the 6,000-year-old Selva Pascuala mural near Cuenca, Spain. This mural has a clear shape outline of a horned bull, and to the bottom right of it, what appears to be a line of many small mushrooms. And in fact, a 2011 paper in the Journal of Economic Botany hypothesized that these small mushrooms shapes resemble a kind of psychoactive mushroom native to the area called Psilocybe hispanica. Okay, very interesting, right? Now let's fast forward several thousand years to talk about the ancient and mysterious drink called Soma. First, we need to mention the Rig Veda, and this is one of the oldest religious texts in existence, written down around 4,000 years ago, and the Rig Veda is still a foundation of Hinduism today. Now, the Rig Veda is split into 10 different books, which are called mandalas. And here's something very fascinating. The ninth mandala, which makes up 10% of this entire ancient text, is entirely dedicated to a mysterious drink called Soma and the religious rituals surrounding Soma. There are over 114 hymns praising the magical and healing properties of this drink. And here is an example of how these hymns sound. This is going to be a quote from the Rig Veda, and the translation is from this Fruit of the Gods book. Quote, "It is drunk by the sick man as medicine at sunrise. Partaking of it strengthens the limbs, preserves the legs from breaking, wards off all disease, and lengthens life. Then need and trouble vanish away. Pinching want is driven off and flees when the inspiring one lays hold of the mortal. The poor man in the intoxication of Soma feels himself rich. The draught impels the singer to lift his voice and inspires him for song. It gives the poet supernatural power so that he feels himself immortal." End quote. In short, Soma sounds like powerful, almost miraculous stuff. So, what was it? Well, that's the mystery. Nobody really knows. The true identity of Soma was slowly forgotten over thousands of years of cultural and environmental changes. But recently, several scholars have tried to guess what this ancient drink was. And the Rig Veda contains some hints. It says Soma was made from a mountain plant. It also says Soma was drunk before battle by warriors. So some scholars have speculated the drink was based on the plant ephedra, which contains the powerful stimulant ephedrine. Others argue that cannabis must have been the main ingredient of Soma, or perhaps it was a plant called Paganum harmala, which has psychoactive properties. In 1971, an author that Terence McKenna highly respects, named Gordon Wasson, published a book called Soma, Divine Mushroom of Immortality, where he argued that a non-psilocybin mushroom called Amanita muscaria was the main ingredient in Soma. This mushroom, which is bright red with white spots on the cap, is an image that most of us are very familiar with. It became the archetypal mushroom depicted in fairy tales and later even in Super Mario Bros. And emojis. We've seen this mushroom image everywhere. And this mushroom contains two mind-altering neurotoxins called ibotenic acid and muscimol. In fact, some people leave bits of this mushroom in milk, like on the windowsill, to kill flies, earning it the nickname fly agaric. However, those who have tested consuming this mushroom, including Terence McKenna himself, found it gives not a very positive experience. McKenna says the only effect that he and his companions felt after eating it was nausea and sleepiness. Certainly nothing like what's described in the Rig Veda. But that book did open McKenna's mind to the possibility that someone is based on a mushroom. The Rig Veda does say the cow is the embodiment of Soma, which implies a strong connection between the two. Cows themselves attain the sacred status in Hinduism with their dung and urine used in rituals. And of course, psilocybin mushrooms grow in cow dung, one of their preferred places to grow. And certainly, psilocybin, which gives otherworldly hallucinogenic experiences, is one of the few substances which might live up to the ecstatic verses in the Rig Veda. All right, so a summary of this third lesson is some prehistoric art depicts mushrooms, including in Algeria, paintings of a figure believed to be a shaman wearing a bee mask, fists full of mushrooms, and covered in small mushrooms from head to toe. Another 6,000-year-old mural in Spain depicts a bull standing near a line of small mushrooms that some scientists believe resemble a local species of psilocybin mushrooms. And one of the oldest religious texts, the Rig Veda, heavily praises a drink called Soma. Nobody today knows what Soma was made of, really, but many speculate that it must have contained psychoactive or hallucinogenic plants. Okay, on to lesson four. Several thousand years ago, humans shifted from partnership to dominator societies that emphasized hierarchy, conformity, and order. We all have a dim and distant, almost unconscious memory of a long-lost paradise, and proof of this is the story of Adam and Eve living in the lush, abundant Garden of Eden. And the importance of that story can't be overstated. It's the foundational myth, the source code of Western culture. It's at the very beginning of the most widely read book of the past 2,000 years. And while some people, especially those steeped in scientific materialism, would say the story is just a stale superstition designed to frighten people into obedience, well, maybe there's more to it than that. Carl Jung would say the Adam and Eve myth, this myth arose out of humanity's collective unconscious, and that's why the story speaks to something deep inside each of us. It seems to communicate something about the nature of reality that we all feel to be intuitively true, even if most of our rational minds do not accept it as scientifically true. And what does it mean that the foundational book of Western civilization right at the beginning tells a story of humans finding and consuming a psychoactive plant? What does it mean that their eyes were then opened and they became self-conscious? As Terence McKenna jokes, this sounds like the story of history's first drug bust. Now, what if the Garden of Eden was not just a myth? What if it represents some repressed memory of a time that actually existed? Well, when we look at some prehistoric cultures, we see an emphasis on respect for nature and all that is life-giving and nurturing. For example, ancient cities like Catalhoyuk or the island of Minoa contained many female figurines that far outnumbered male ones, and these were likely tributes to female fertility or goddesses. This is a stark contrast to the Abrahamic religions over the past couple thousand years that have always represented God as a solitary, old, white, bearded man. Now, Terence McKenna says that 7 to 10,000 years ago, our archaic ancestors indeed lived in a very different society than most of us do today. Because of rituals involving psychoactive plants, they regularly experienced oneness with nature and the dissolution of their personal ego. And these experiences created a shift in values toward worship of the mother goddess and a more egalitarian, harmonious social structure, values typically connected more to the feminine domain. But 5 to 7,000 years ago, invasions of warlike nomadic tribes brought an end to that era and shifted us to what could be described as dominator societies. These societies were now based on rigid hierarchy, authority, conformity, control, and they rely on on violence to survive. Ryan Eisler first coined these terms, partnership and dominator societies, in her best-selling book, The Chalice and the Blade, some decades ago. So, With the rise of dominator societies, the plant-based and open-ended shamanistic spirituality of partnership societies was quickly suppressed, and it was replaced with traditions of dogma and priestly hierarchies. The dominator social structures knew instinctively that altered states of consciousness are an existential threat to them. Why? Because certain plant rituals dissolve ego boundaries and help one see oneself as part of the interconnected web of life, a view tinted with the feminine. And this value shift led to new social and gender imbalances, and plenty of wars, and as we are now seeing, the destruction of nature itself. Dominator societies also have a hostile attitude towards sexuality, another perfectly natural experience that is taboo because it dissolves ego boundaries. In old dominator societies, the relationships between men and women are centered on men being sought for security and apparent status, while in partnership societies, this was less likely to happen because kids were raised in a more group-minded way and resources were more equally distributed among all members rather than accumulating to a few older males. And what arose with dominator societies also was monotheism. As Terence McKenna describes it, here's a quote, "Monotheism exhibits what is essentially a pathological personality pattern projected onto the ideal of God, the pattern of the paranoid, possessive, power-obsessed male ego. This God is not someone you would care to invite to a garden party." End quote. Related to this is how much of a threat the medieval church saw in witchcraft. Just 400 years ago, the medieval followers of Christ were so terrified of witches, they murdered at least 30,000 through torture and burnings. It's probably not a coincidence that most of these were female, as spiritual knowledge of the natural world is felt to be a feminine domain even today. As an aside, the plants usually associated with European witchcraft, like thornapple, mandrake, and nightshade, are not hallucinogenic, but they are psychoactive in a way, producing states of delirium and derangement, and that may explain the image of the mad, cackling witch. So a summary of this lesson: perhaps prehistoric people, inspired by hallucinogenic ego-dissolving experiences, structured their societies around partnership values like harmony, equality, and worship of the mother goddess. And the abundance of female figurines found in places like Catalhoyuk or Minoa hint at this. But later these were replaced with so-called dominator values in societies that practice religious dogmatism and emphasize hierarchy, order, and strict boundaries. Okay, now we're on to lesson 5, which is personal, social, and ecological balance in the world may be restored by shamanic plant rituals. Albert Hofmann was a chemist working for a pharmaceutical company in Switzerland. In 1943, while researching different chemicals, he was the first person to synthesize lysergic acid diethylamide, also called LSD. He synthesized it and then forgot about it for years while World War II happened. But after the war, he randomly returned to this chemical again, and a small amount of LSD accidentally touched his skin, and it triggered effects like a very active imagination and sensitivity to light. And it was then that Hofmann knew he'd found something very peculiar with this new substance. So 3 days later, on April 19th, 1943, Hofmann intentionally now ingested 250 milligrams of LSD, and he thought this was a very small dose, but because LSD is so concentrated, it was actually a very high dose, and LSD takes an hour or more to kick in, so Hofmann didn't feel the effects right away, and when he felt nothing after a while, he decided to begin riding his bike home from work, as is normal in Switzerland. Needless to say, in the middle of his bike ride, the hallucinogenic effects of LSD came on so strongly that he couldn't make it all the way. Well, thankfully, he had a co-worker escorting him, but, you know, it's quite the experience. Now, Albert Hofmann gave a speech more recently on his 100th birthday in 2006, and he said, and I quote, that LSD gave me an inner joy, an open-mindedness, a gratefulness, open eyes, and an internal sensitivity for the miracles of creation. I think that in human evolution, it has never been as necessary to have this substance LSD. It is just a tool to turn us into what we are supposed to be. End quote. So decades later, and he's, I guess he was a fan until his death of what he discovered. Now let's talk about the 60s. A couple decades after that discovery, the LSD went mainstream in the 60s. And that was probably due to the efforts of figures like Timothy Leary, who was a controversial professor at Harvard, who promoted the use of LSD. And the 1960s were an extraordinary window where sudden widespread use of psychoactive substances like LSD or marijuana brought tremendous social change. It was an amount of social turbulence not seen in America in at least 100 years and probably not seen since then. Well, Terence McKenna describes hallucinogens as deconditioning agents, and in the 60s, they allowed the younger generation to see the relativity of cultural values and therefore gave them the freedom not to conform to those values. And at the same time, there was an explosion of new colors, music, and art, the vibrant and groundbreaking music of the Beatles being a good example. Yet, near the end of the 60s, the government seemingly panicked at what was happening and prohibited all psychedelics, including those that nobody had even heard of at the time, like ibogaine and bufotenin. And this move was not based on any medical or scientific evidence. In fact, a lot of promising scientific research being done at the time was also soon squeezed out of existence. For example, several clinics had been using LSD to treat alcoholism, and a recent meta-analysis just a few years ago of those early studies found that 59% of patients improved with the help of LSD compared to 38% in the control group. Further, those researchers noted how patients commonly felt they had gained significant insights into their problems and been given a new lease on life. And they said this might be the result of LSD binding with certain serotonin receptors in the brain, stimulating new connections and opening the mind to new possibilities. Nonetheless, psychedelics became taboo, not only in the social world, but also in the scientific world, and research was basically not funded into them for decades until very recently. In the past 10 years, there has been a kind of renaissance in psychedelic research led by Roland Griffiths at the Johns Hopkins University. And his most well-known study up to now was in giving psilocybin to terminally ill cancer patients. And he found that large and long-lasting decreases in depression and anxiety in these patients after just one dose of psilocybin. And 6 months later, participants continue to report the very high improvements in quality of life, which is an unprecedented result. Well, now let's switch gears again a little and look at ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is a particularly powerful psychoactive brew made by indigenous people living in the Amazon basin, and it has a long shamanic tradition behind it. And to make ayahuasca, you need two different plants. First, you need leaves from the Psychotria virgis plant, which contains dimethyltryptamine, or DMT for short. And you also need vines of another plant called Banisteriopsis caapi, which contains what's called MAO inhibitors. Now, here's something crazy. Either of these plants consumed alone does nothing. But when consumed together, the MAO inhibitors allow the DMT in the other plant to enter the brain's serotonin receptors and create the most intense visionary experiences. Well, this raises the question, how did the native people learn to boil these two specific plants together out of thousands found in the Amazon? Well, nobody knows, and it's quite the mystery, especially considering the mechanism of MAO inhibition was not known by modern chemistry, even to the 1950s. Now, in the past 20 years, knowledge and interest in ayahuasca has increased greatly among American and European people, and many centers have opened in Peru and nearby countries offering ayahuasca retreats, mainly to Westerners. Now, this rise in popularity may look a little strange when you know the effects of ayahuasca. First, the natives call it La Purga, or the purge, because it induces intense vomiting and intermittent diarrhea, although that was probably effective at purging tropical worms and parasites for the native people. Now, the indigenous people also consider the brew a general healing elixir, effective at clearing stuck emotional patterns and negative energy. Traditionally, ayahuasca is taken as a sacrament in the presence of a shaman. The shaman drinks the brew with the patient and sings magical songs called ikaros, meant to direct your hallucinatory visions and ward off evil spirits. And by all accounts, ayahuasca is an incredibly intense experience. Some people, when they hear the word drug, they may imagine a euphoric high or a drunken stupor, but these effects from this psychedelic ayahuasca is far more interesting and usually far less comfortable. As McKenna describes it, and I quote, "The mind and the self literally unfold before one's eyes. There is a sense that one is made new yet unchanged, as if one were made of gold and had just been recast in the furnace of one's birth." End quote. Anyway, McKenna says that these kinds of archaic, ego-dissolving rituals are one thing that's really missing in modern society. Rituals or rites of passage that give us a vivid and direct experience of our connection to Mother Nature. And without these kinds of experiences, we become blind to the reality that we are in an interdependent relationship with everything in the world. And this kind of blindness is resulting in ecological catastrophe, personal and existential alienation, and new kinds of social imbalances. And maybe the way out of all these modern problems and neuroses is not more political exhortation, but a return to archaic rituals that our ancestors probably used, rituals that shake each of us individually to our very roots. Here's a summary of this lesson. Whether it is the traditional Amazon brew, ayahuasca, or the recently discovered LSD, many people report significant psychological benefits. And that doesn't mean that society should fall into wild experimentation with these substances like many youths did in the 1960s. However, scientific research into psychedelics is being reawakened and reinforcing these views of significant benefits for depression, addiction, and mental health. Okay, and finally we're on to lesson 6, a very important one. This lesson is, addiction is a serious problem, and hallucinogens may help to curb it. When talking about psychoactive substances, it's very important to talk about addiction. Now, the word drug itself is a very broad and imprecise category, but let's look at the dominant social attitude toward so-called drugs anyway. Now, those who advocate a war on drugs see them as a corrupting influence that, if allowed to exist, will spread like an infection across the population, trapping masses of people into a hedonistic, obsessive, and endless chase for selfish gratification. For example, we all know that heroin is one of the most addictive drugs. More importantly, heroin addicts are scary people. There's a reason why they've been called dope fiends. The definition of a fiend is an evil spirit or demon. So heroin addicts are described as possessed by some evil demon. And McKenna says that the face of evil is the face of total need. So when someone is in the grips of a heroin addiction, they are in total need, which means they will do practically anything for their next dose, including lying, cheating, stealing, betraying their friends, or worse. Just as a rabid dog cannot control itself, a heroin fiend is also to some extent controlled and helpless. And from this perspective, it makes sense that so many people, most people, would want to fight a war on substances like this. Now, here's a quote from a different book. The book is The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. And the quote is, "Of the good in you I can speak, but not of the evil. For what is good, evil but good tortured by its own hunger and thirst? Verily, when good is hungry, it seeks food even in dark caves, and when it thirsts, it drinks even of dead waters." End quote. Now let's step back for a moment. Opium, which is what heroin is made of, opium has been consumed by people for thousands of years. And the earliest evidence of poppy seed pods, which is what opium is made from, the earliest evidence for those poppy seed pods in human settlements dates back 4,200 years in Spain. In fact, most ancient civilizations that we know of used opium medically, recreationally, or both, and this includes ancient Sumerians, Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, Arabs, and more. It was used medically as the strongest known form of pain relief, even mentioned in most of the very important early medical texts, like the Ebers Papyrus, 3,550 years ago. Opium also carried a reputation as an aphrodisiac and male potency enhancer in many places. Yet despite this widespread use, there's virtually no mention of opium addiction in those old texts. Well, for most of history, opium was not injected or even smoked, which might explain that. The sticky resin from the poppy flower seed pods was either dissolved in wine or it was swallowed whole as a pellet. And it was only in 1805 that a young German chemist named Friedrich Sertürner isolated the active alkaloid in the poppy plant, and he named it morphine after the Greek god of dreams, Morpheus. Now, according to the DEA, morphine is 10 times more powerful than processed opium, quantity for quantity. And then, in 1853, the hypodermic syringe was invented, giving doctors a way to inject doses of morphine quickly and efficiently. Very soon after, it was so common for soldiers returning from war, like from the Civil War, to be addicted to morphine that some journalists began calling it the soldier's disease. And by 1888, opiates made up 15% of all prescriptions in Boston. And throughout the 1870s and 1880s, medical journals began filling up with warnings about the dangers of morphine addiction. And this grew into a post-Civil War opium epidemic that peaked around 1903, which many believe that this epidemic eventually subsided due to changes in doctors' prescribing behaviors. Terence McKenna says, "This is a dark pattern that most drugs seem to take as our technology evolves. The new drugs are ever more concentrated, ever more potent, and ever more addictive than what came before." And that brings us to the modern opiate epidemic happening in America and many other industrialized countries today. Heroin, as the first semi-synthetic opiate, replaced morphine for most addicts when it was introduced. And now the dramatic surge in overdose deaths in the Western world starting in the 2010s is due to fentanyl, which is an even more concentrated and dangerous synthetic opioid. From the year 2000 to 2006, the overdose rate in the U.S. Quadrupled, mainly because of fentanyl and similar new substances. As another example of this pattern, here what McKenna says based on his research into the use of alcohol. Here's a quote. "Human use of alcohol in the form of fermented grains, juices, and med is extremely ancient. Distilled spirits, in contrast, were not known to the ancients. Alcoholism as a social and community problem appears to have been rare before the discovery of distillation." End quote. This being the reality, we need to take the problem of addiction very seriously because it's very likely that it'll become worse in the future with increases in technology. So this means putting aside failed approaches that have failed miserably in the past, like prohibition. And it's ironic in a way that These psychoactive plants may represent a future path out of addiction. A recent pilot study done by Johns Hopkins tried giving one dose of psilocybin in a therapeutic setting to 15 people who had repeatedly failed to quit cigarettes. Most of these patients quit smoking, and after 6 months, they found that 80% of the subjects continued to be abstinent. Now, the head researcher of this study was Roland Griffiths, who we've mentioned a couple times already, and when asked about these positive results, he said, quote, "People who have taken psilocybin appear to have more confidence in their ability to change their own behavior and to manage their addictions. Prior to this experience, quite often the individual feels they have no freedom relative to their addiction, that they are hooked and they don't have the capacity to change. But after an experience of this sort, which is like backing up and seeing the larger picture, they begin to ask themselves, why would I think that I couldn't stop cigarette smoking?" End quote. Now let's take another step back. What is addiction anyway? Well, defined in the broadest way, an addiction is something that causes compulsive behavior. In fact, to see addiction only as the consumption of certain substances is a very narrow view. And therefore, McKenna says we should have a new definition of drug as well. And his definition is something that causes unexamined, obsessive, and habitual behavior. End quote. If our goal is to thrive collectively as a society, then we need to examine all sources of these compulsive and destructive behavior patterns. Take television, for example. I mean, we've all heard the shocking statistic before that most people spend 4 to 6 hours per day watching television. Of course, now the internet and mobile devices have somewhat replaced television. And according to a 2018 Nielsen report, the average adult now spends over 11 hours every day watching or interacting with media. 11 hours every day. So this habit has many destructive effects. It deteriorates relationships, harms health, and erodes attention spans. But beyond that, television and other media also makes us into the consumers of the images that other people want to feed us. As McKenna says, quote, "Television is by nature the dominator drug par excellence. Control of content, uniformity of content, repeatability of content make it inevitably a tool of coercion, brainwashing, and manipulation," end quote. Even worse, these digital addictions seem to be following a similar trend as the physical drugs did. Over time, they're becoming more potent. We went from a weekly newspaper to a daily news hour to now our phones constantly buzzing in our pockets. Is there any way out of this? Well, decades before the term psychedelic caught on, these plants and substances were called consciousness expanding. Aldous Huxley wrote about how they opened the doors of perception and helped him to reconnect with the world as it is, including deeper self-reflection. And if Terence McKenna is right, and consciousness-expanding plants accidentally opened the doors of perception for us Homo sapiens thousands of years ago, then perhaps after being slammed shut for so long, the door is creaking open again. And maybe this time, in contrast to the wild 1960s counterculture, these archaic sacraments can be reintroduced on a solid foundation and become an integral part of future mental health and individual religious inquiry. And let's finish off with one last quote. "Our addictions down through the ages, from sugar to cocaine to television, have been a restless search for the thing torn from us in paradise. The answer has been found. It is no longer something to be sought. It has been found." End quote. All right, so I hope you enjoyed this, my notes on this book. Very thought-provoking. And to get more book notes and lessons, head on over to growth.me, where you can also read this as a long-form article. And I'll see you again in the next one.